Well, thank you, Brother Andrew, and good evening, brothers and sisters. Young people, what a crackingly cold night it is. You all look like you just want to go back to the fire. Those people out there suffered the rays of the sun this morning. Hypothermia is about to set in, so just keep your eye. Every 10 or so minutes, just see how they're going out there under those trees and on that grass. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, if you wanted a summary of 1 Samuel 5 and 1 Samuel 6, you could do no better than go to Hannah's prayer. You come back with me and have a look at 1 Samuel 2 and just look how wonderfully succinct this amazing woman really captures the events that are about to happen. You go to verse 9 and you read these words of 1 Samuel 2. He will keep the feet of his saints, and the wicked shall be silent in darkness. For, now here's the summary of these two chapters, for by strength shall no man prevail. The adversaries of Yahweh shall be broken to pieces. And then she goes on and talks about him thundering from heaven. Oh, that's going to happen in chapter 7. So she's got this mind that takes her a few years into the future and a mind that takes her way, way, way into the future, millennia into the future, when she finishes this little prayer on the note of the Messiah. The question, brothers and sisters, always goes begging when you think about Hannah, is how could this woman be so spiritual and so confident? I mean, we grasp this, don't we? Desperately grasp to have this kind of spirituality and this kind of confidence. How did she do it? And how did she do it so joyfully? Well, the answer is, brothers and sisters, that she gave back to God in full what God had first given to her joyfully. And you and I are called to do exactly the same. Now, what I want to do for our first few minutes is just pull together this lesson of Hannah and just to see how she rose to such spiritual heights. There is a lesson for you and me. She was able to write or utter this prayer because she had just given back to God exactly what God had first given to her. And she was able to do it because she was God-centered. Now, some of you have heard this before, many of you haven't. It's worth a couple of minutes. Come to Matthew 25. This is you and me. This is you and me in Hannah's shoes. How could she do it? Well, Matthew 25 tells us. And what we are to do. Exactly what this woman did 3,000 years ago. It's a simple story. It's a Sunday school story. It's the parable of the talents. And in verse 14, we read these words. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man travelling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave five, to another he gave two, and to another one, every man according to his several abilities, and he took his journey. Now, brothers and sisters, let's square one thing off, and that is this. These talents are not something we're born with and we use in God's service. We're not talking about something natural that we've got, that we then give to God. These talents are what God has first given to us. The talents here is a gift, and that's what the word means, a gift. To apportion out. And in the first instance, it was the spirit gifts that were given to the apostles and the disciples. It's what God had given to them. And then God comes back through the Lord Jesus Christ and expects us to give back exactly what God had first given to us. Now, the key to this and understanding how we fit into Hannah's spirituality is this. You notice in verse 14, he called his servants and delivered to them his talents. Now that's an important word because you'll find that only two of the three men or three persons here that are given the talents, only two of them re-echo, deliver back the same words. Look at verse 20. He that had received the five talents came and brought other five, saying to the Lord, thou deliverest. He uses the same word. The two-talent person in verse 22 did exactly the same. He also that had received two talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest. Now, what the one-talent man didn't do that. Never used the word. Now, the word, brothers and sisters, is so important. The Apostle Paul in Romans 6 says this: thou hast obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered to you. We use those expressions when we often baptize people. You have received from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered to you. Now, if you went to Romans 6, those famous words, and looked in your margin, it's not you've obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine which was delivered to you. The Greek is which you have been delivered unto. We've obeyed the gospel that we have been delivered to. And Paul uses the example in Romans 6 of a mould. He said, you have been delivered to the mould, and the mould is the gospel. And when you've been poured into the gospel, into that mould, when you're lifted out, you look exactly the same as what you've been delivered to. Ah, the five-talent man got it. So did the two-talent man. Because when they came before their Lord, they said, I understand God manifestation. I understand what I'm supposed to do in this life. I'm supposed to replicate God. You gave me five, the gift from God. I will return exactly what you gave me. The two-talent man, you gave me these two, a gift from God. I will deliver exactly back to you what you gave me in full. And the way they did it was how Hannah did it. Totally God-centered. If she was herself-centered, she would never have taken Samuel. God-centered. Because both of these men, in verse 20 and in verse 22, the first word that comes out of their mouth is, Lord, thou. Lord, thou. That's how you understand God manifestation. And the one talent man said, I. I. No way could he understand that principle of God manifestation. And so therefore, brothers and sisters, Hannah was able to rise to that spirituality, and you and I are called upon to do exactly the same. And it's all about the ark, you see, the principle of God manifestation. Why is it, brethren and sisters, when brethren and sisters lose God-centeredness in their life, when they lose their way, when God is no longer the centre of their life, but they are, when they lose their way, the tragedy is that even the fear of death is not enough to bring them back. When brethren lose their way, the knowledge that God still exists is not enough to bring them back. The Philistines in chapter 5 and chapter 6 were surrounded by death. Their gods had toppled over, the people were smitten, the crops were devastated. They didn't go to God. The Philistines, brothers and sisters, in chapters 5 and chapter 6 were totally aware that God existed, but they never turned to him. What turns you and me back to God when we find ourselves straying? What keeps us under the arches and the umbrella of God's love and care and stops us from straying in the first place? I think, brothers and sisters, we know the answer. What really keeps us, not fear. What keeps us, brothers and sisters, is a desire to be close to him. What keeps us is a desire to be like him. And those tenants were in the ark. They resided in the ark. Now, as we turn our attention to chapters 5 and chapter 6, I want you to note that the first five verses of chapter 5, Dagon is referred to exactly double the amount of times as the ark. So as we read the first five verses of this chapter, we don't have to second guess one whit the Philistines' hierarchy of importance when it came to setting Dagon and the ark side by side. But after the first five verses, throughout the rest of this chapter and embracing all of chapter 6, the ark is referred to no less than 27 times and Dagon zero. So if the Philistines are keeping score, brothers and sisters and young people, then they're in for a big disappointment. And no disappointment, however, could match that of the woman who closed the fourth chapter. You remember this afternoon, there was no joy, or this morning, there was no joy, there was no peace, there was no hope for that woman, Phinehas's wife. Just incredible pain as it turned upon her. A new life is going to come into the world, but without God it meant absolutely nothing. The ark had gone, and with it so had this woman's life. Now we would have hoped, after having read that close of chapter 4, we would have hoped, having heard the cry of that woman as she turned away from her newborn child, wouldn't be comforted, we would have hoped, brothers and sisters, that the nation would have been galvanized into action. We could have anticipated the next thing we read in verse 1 of chapter 5 in the opening words is that all Israel was set as one man determined to bring back the ark or die in the process. Nothing. No attempt. No treaty. No ransom. Nothing. It's gone. Nothing we can do about it. Just let it go. You know, they might have had the softness to lament the loss of the ark, and all the city of Shiloh cried out, where was the hardness, brothers and sisters and young people? Where was the hardness to take the step, the right step to recover the ark? The ark will have to help itself because I won't. You ever heard that? Oh, they'll have to do it themselves. I'm not getting involved. Not my job. The ecclesia's not going too well. Well, it's not my problem. I'm going into my house and shutting my door. I'm looking after my own, thank you very much. Ever heard yourself say that, brothers and sisters? It'll just have to help itself. I've got things to do. I've got a wheat harvest to reap, as the men of Beth Shemesh were doing. We know, brothers and sisters, their indifference. We know their lack of zeal. We know their lack of interest. You have a look at 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verse 13. Verse 13, 1 Samuel 6, and they of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley. And they lifted up their eyes and they saw the ark, and they were happy. This is great. 7 months gone. Well, here it is back again. So here the men are going about their worldly business and the ark just turns up, unannounced, unexpected. If they had been keenly interested, brethren, sisters and young people, if they had been keenly interested in this ark, then they would have had some private intelligence as to its movement. They would have been alert to the fact that this ark was moving from Ekron, but they never met it. They didn't escort it to their borders. They were careless of its place. I've got wheat to reap. Thank you. Oh, it's turned up on its own. Well, what do you know? How about that? Pretty sad, brothers and sisters. Out of sight, out of mind. But for the Philistines, all a different situation, a different story. The ark was far from being out of their sight, and it was definitely not out of their mind. And God was going to make absolutely sure of that. So, chapter 5, and when you read verses 1 and 2, there's a repetition of expression. So verse 1 and verse 2 we read, the Philistines took the ark of God. Verse 2, and when the Philistines took the ark of God, did they? The men of Beth Shemesh thought they did, because they said, oh, we've got to get rid of this ark. They're doing exactly what the Philistines were doing. We're going to get rid of this ark. We've had people slain in our midst. We better send it off to the men of Kirjath-Jearim. And they said to the men of Kirjath-Jearim, didn't mention that there were 70 people that were slain, but they sent the ark off to the men of Kirjath-Jearim saying, oh, the Philistines have brought it back. So the men of Beth Shemesh believed that the Philistines had taken it in the first place and now they've brought it back. God didn't say that. God didn't say that at all. The Philistines did not take it, did they? Psalm 78, brothers and sisters, look at Psalm 78. God tells us exactly how the ark left Ebenezer. Starts off in verse 1 and 2 of chapter 5 of 1 Samuel saying the Philistines did. Well, that was their impression. But God had another. So Psalm 78, and we read in verse 59. Psalm 78, when God heard this, he was wroth and greatly abhorred Israel, so that he forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he'd placed among them, and God delivered his strength, into captivity and his glory into the enemy's hand. Now the word strength there, the first time that word is used in the Old Testament is in Exodus 15 and verse 2, and it's the song of Moses. So the first time we read of the word is when Moses, in glorious triumph, is singing the song, Yahweh is my strength. He hath triumphed gloriously and hath thrown the rider into the sea. Well, it's gone. And along with the strength of God, the glory of God has gone as well. And so we read, therefore, in chapter 5 of 1 Samuel, that the ark went then from the stone of help, which they didn't understand at that stage, the ark went from Ebenezer, and the ark then went, brothers and sisters, to Ashdod. Now, Ashdod's an interesting place. The word means, in the Hebrew, the ravager. It comes from the root word, which means to be burly, to be powerful, to be impregnable. And so the city of Ashdod had a reputation of being a powerful fortress. Now, I ask you this morning to keep that in mind, because Aphek means a fortress. Ashdod has the idea of being a powerful fortress. You wait, you see what God is going to do with the fortress on the Philistines. Well, they took the ark from Ebenezer, or from Aphek, down to Ashdod. And this was a clear declaration, brothers and sisters and young people, that they had ravaged Israel. I'm going to put into a place that declares, we in Ashdod, the ravager, we have ravaged Israel, and we now have power over their God. And as a trophy of the victory to honour their own god Dagon, they placed the ark at Dagon's feet. Now Dagon, a couple of minutes on Dagon. Interesting god. Dagon is the Semite god of seed, of crops, of vegetation. You see, the Hebrew word for corn or grain or wheat is Dagan. In Genesis 27 and verse 28, we read these words. Genesis 27 and 28, we read, therefore, God give thee of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn, plenty of Dagan and wine. But it's often held that Dagon was the Canaanite version of the fish god. Now, the idea of that, brothers and sisters and young people, is that the Hebrew word for fish is dag. So if you go fishing, you're going dagging, you see. Now, what you see, brothers and sisters, is the idea of this idea that Dagon was a fish god comes out in the AV margin of 1 Samuel 5 and verse 4. You look at your margin in 1 Samuel 5 and verse 4. It says in the margin, only the fishy part was left. The problem with that is this, is the phrase in italics, in this verse, verse 4, the phrase in italics, only the stump of Dagon was left, is actually taken from the Septuagint version. So in your italics, you've got a Septuagint section lifted out, plonked in here, and then you get a marginal reference of a Septuagint translation or borrowing into the Hebrew there. The Hebrew is just simply, in this verse, only Dagon was left to him, not the fishy part. So the fish theory is somewhat suspect, and it's actually widely questioned by experts in Babylonian studies. On the other hand, rats and mice overran the country in Philistia, devastating their crops and turning the nation into a dust bowl. So if Dagon, brothers and sisters, is the god presiding over seed, which I think he was, then his power is seriously challenged by rats. Now that's pretty fitting. And therefore, brothers and sisters, it's no wonder that the Philistines made all these images of mice or rats in chapter 6 and verse 5. Whatever he looked like, whether he looked like a stick of corn or whether he looked like a fish, whether he looked like, brothers and sisters and young people, God was going to shame him or it and the rest of them along with it. So we look at the record, therefore, in 1 Samuel 5 and verse 3, and we read these words. God is going to shame them, 1 Samuel 5 and verse 3. And when they of Ashdod rose early on the morrow, behold, Dagon was fallen upon his face to the earth before the ark of Yahweh. Now, you know, brothers and sisters, people like this went to great care when they set up their images to fix them. Enormous trouble and care was taken that when they set them up, they made absolutely certain that they were secure and fixed so that they would not be moved. And Isaiah the prophet actually took careful note about how much care these people went to make sure their gods didn't move. Just come with me, if you will, for a moment to Isaiah 41 and verse 7. Isaiah noted this, how much care they took in setting up their gods, but fixing them, you see, fixing them. You listen to these words in Isaiah 41 and verse 7. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith, and he that smootheth with the hammer, him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering, and he fastened it with nails that it should not be moved. Now, I want to read to you Rotherham's translation. It's quite humorous when you sort of really listen to the words. Rotherham in verse 7 says it this way. So the carver hath encouraged the goldsmith. He that maketh smooth with the hammer, him that smiteth the anvil, saying, of the welder it is good. And he that fastened it with nails, it must not totter. That's how they view these odd. We've fastened him. He must not, it's good. He must not totter. But he fell. Dagon fell. Immovable, they thought, but he fell. And when he fell, brothers and sisters and young people, he couldn't get up. They had to carry him back and set him back in his place. And Isaiah again picks us up laboriously, taking us through these words in Isaiah 46. Look at Isaiah 46, verses 1 through 7. Have a listen to how these stupid people, and we look at them and say, how stupid. You're fixing an idol so it doesn't move. When it falls over, you've got to go over and pick it up and put it back. Don't laugh at them, brothers and sisters and young people, because we do exactly the same. You listen to this, verse 1. Baal boweth down, Isaiah 46. Baal boweth down, Nebo stoopeth. Their idols were upon the beasts and upon the cattle. Your carriages were heavy loaden. They are a burden to the weary beast. They stoop, they bow down together. They could not deliver the burden, but themselves have gone into captivity. They carry their own gods. But God says in verse 3, by contrast, listen to me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me. Talk about carrying. I am the one that's carried you from the womb. Even to your old age I am he. And even to hoar hairs I will carry you. I've made, I will bear. I'm God and I'm going to carry you, the worshippers. It's the other way around with these Philistines. Even I will carry and I will deliver you. God alone can do that, brothers and sisters. And there were men thinking that they were over the ark. And God was supreme. And that declaration was made when the men of the Philistines came in the next morning and saw Dagon flat on his face. As the Septuagint says, when they came in the morning, they found Dagon flat on his face before the ark in a posture of adulation before that ark. They prayed to that God for help. Imagine it, praying to this God, and he's flat on his face, and you're praying to him, can you help me? And the God's saying, well, I will if you pick me up. You see, brethren and sisters, Dagon needs their help. Those that made the God, now be very, very, very attentive to this, those that made the God were like the God. And when the God fell, they fell with it, and there was no power in them to get up, like there was no power in the God to get up. Brothers and sisters and young people, listen to me, and older brothers and sisters, listen to me. What we love, we are inevitably like. And when what we love falls, we fall with it. I can't believe some people, when their football team loses, they've got to go to counselling sessions to get over the hurt. My team's lost. Well, get over it. Brothers and sisters, remember that, young people. If you love something really passionate enough and it falls flat on its face, you go with it. And therefore, these Philistines, blind to the significance of the occasion, they sent him back in his place again, and he fell flat on his face again. If he was a fish, he was a flathead, let me tell you, brothers and sisters. And so this time, when they come in there, he's fallen flat on his face, and he's got no head and he's got no hands. So there on the threshold, God is clearly declaring, you reckon he had an intelligence? Well, look at it. There's the intelligence removed from the body. You reckon he had any power? Well, there's his power. His hands are cut off and they're on the threshold. And it was no accident. No accident at all. These bits, the head and the hands, the thing didn't fall over and the hands break and the head broke into a dozen pieces. In the record, brothers and sisters and young people, in 1 Samuel 5 and verse 4, where it says the head of Dagon and both the palms of his hands were cut off on the threshold. In the Hebrew, it means to sever by cutting with a blade. Oh, you would have gone in there. You would have gone in there and you would have saw a neat, like a laser, right across there. Really sharp and smooth. Really sharp. That is spooky. Really spooky, brothers and sisters. He hadn't toppled over. Somebody had been in there. Someone had been in there and gone up to the head and cut it off with a knife and got up to the hands and cut the hands off with a knife and laid them on the threshold. Dagon's hands were gone. What about God's? You know, the record really is very, very poetic. You have a look at 1 Samuel 5. The hands of Dagon are gone, clean cut off. Where are God's hands? Three cities, brothers and sisters. Verse 6, he's in Ashdod. The hand of Yahweh is in Ashdod. Well, verse 9, and the hand of Yahweh was in Gath. Well, verse 11, and the hand of Yahweh was very heavy in Ekron. Dagon's hands are gone, but the Philistines knew whether it was Ashdod, whether it was Gath, whether it was Ekron, they couldn't run away from the hand of God. Powerful, brothers and sisters, absolutely powerful. And it's put there to show us, by contrast, that God's hands were very, very busy. And verse 6 of 1 Samuel 5, we read, but the hand of Yahweh was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them. Now the word Ashdod, as we've already said, is the word which means ravisher. The word destroyed there in the Hebrew means to stun. So when you look at this verse, we read the verse, the hand of Yahweh was upon the ravager, and he stunned them. And he smote them with emrods. Now, brothers and sisters, the word emrod, it's a Hebrew word. You remember we talked about Aphek being a fortress, and Ashdod being a fortress. No problems about where the Philistines' mind is. Well, this word emrod in the Hebrew is the Hebrew word ophel, O-P-H-E-L. But the significance of the word means a fort or a stronghold. It's got the idea of a mound or a hill. And it's used to describe the ridge of hills inside of Jerusalem that run due south, just to the west of the temple area. This word emrod is actually translated as tumours in the Revised Standard Version and the NIV. Tumours! And the Septuagint adds to this verse, which we don't have in our AV, adds to this, and he smote them with emrods, even Ashdod on the coast thereof, and mice, this is what the Septuagint says, and mice sprang up in the midst of their country, and there was a great and indiscriminate mortality in the city. So what did God do? These are mice, and these are rats. This is a strong indicator, brothers and sisters, of bubonic plague. And with the bubonic plague, originates with fleas in rats and mice. And within a day, swellings appear. Hard, painful, burning lumps on the neck, under the arms and in the inner thighs. Swellings that are called buboes, the bubonic plague. And they were in the victim's lymph nodes, growing to the size of an orange, turning black and then splitting open. And the victim's nervous system collapsed, causing dreadful and bizarre neurological disorders. What God did to the Philistines was saying, you like your fortresses? Well, here I'm going to give you little fortresses all over your body full of poison. That's how God dealt with them. In 1 week, the victim was dead. Don't boast in your fortresses of poison, because this is what your fortresses of poison will end up doing to you. They'll break out upon you and they'll kill you. In fact, you have a look at verse 9 of 1 Samuel 5. You read this, just in case anybody's got some ideas of what this might or might not mean. Verse 9, and it was so that after they had carried it about, the hand of Yahweh was against the city with a very great destruction, and he smote the men of the city, both small and great, and they had emrods in their secret parts. Brothers and sisters, the RSV simply says, so that tumours broke out upon them. That's what it says in the Hebrew. Tumours broke out or erupted upon them. In the Hebrew, tumours had broken out and erupted. Oh, and they knew that it was the ark. They knew where that ark really belonged, but they didn't do anything about it, brothers and sisters. Look how they knew, and it's constantly repeated in this chapter. The ark of the God of Israel. Look at verse 7. And when the men of Ashdod saw that it was so, they said, the ark of the God of Israel shall not abide with us. Well, send it back. But they didn't. And so therefore you read in verse 8, and they sent, therefore, and gathered all the lords of the Philistines over them, and they said, well, what will we do with the ark of the God of Israel? Well, send it back. They didn't. They answered, let the ark of the God of Israel be carried to Gath. But it doesn't belong in Gath. And they carried the ark of the God of Israel. You see what God's saying? Can't you hear, you Philistines? It's coming out of your own mouth. You know where it belongs. Stop sending it from one city to the other. But they couldn't let go, brothers and sisters. They couldn't let go of this prize. You have it twice in verse 8. You then have it in verse 10. The ark of the God of Israel is in Ekron. And you have it again in verse 11. So they sent and gathered together the lords of the Philistines again and said, send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it go to its own place. Well, hello, it took a long time for the penny to drop. Send it back where it belongs, to Israel. You know, brothers and sisters and young people, Yahweh never acted on these Philistines without a clear warning. Every warning, however, was met with resistance. Dagon fell, they put him back. God was warning them. Dagon was mutilated, they jumped over the threshold. God was warning them. The people were afflicted, they moved the ark. God was warning them. It was punishment by degrees, and still they clung onto their idol. Still they wouldn't give up the ark, because there was too much awe attached to this golden chest. And the victory was too fresh in their minds. So they sent for the lords of the Philistines. Verse 8. So they sent to the lords of the Philistines, and they said, what shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel? Do you know, brothers and sisters, the word lords there in verse 8 is only used 22 times in the Old Testament. Every occasion bar one, it's always used of the five lords of the Philistines. The only other place that it's used is in the 1 Kings chapter 7 and verse 30. And in 1 Kings 7 and verse 30, it's the expression plates of brass. So 21 times it's lords of the Philistines, and once it's plates of brass, describing the hub or the axle of a wheel. In fact, the word lords here in the Hebrew is the word axle. So the lords were the hub around which decisions were made on behalf of their land, and their decision on this occasion, the hub or the axle's decision, was to send it to Gath, and subsequently then, brothers and sisters, sending it on to Ekron. But moving it from one city to the other never solved a thing. And so they were forced to come again and meet. And this time when they came, they met with the magicians. And when they met with the magicians, they cast aside the axle, the plate of brass, and now they're going to meet with their magicians and the advice. In chapter 6, brothers and sisters and young people, the advice was very careful and it was very detailed. These magicians weren't going to make the same mistake that the magicians in Egypt had made. What happened here, or what happened there, of course, in Egypt, was still very much a memory to other nations. And so the diviners in chapter 6 and verse 6 were going to remind these people of the Philistines just who they were dealing with. And therefore, verse 6 of 1 Samuel 6 says this: these are the magicians. Therefore, when you do harden your hearts, wherefore do you harden your hearts, said the magicians, as Pharaoh hardened their hearts when he had wrought wonderfully among them? Did they not let the people go and they departed? So here were these magicians saying, don't make the same mistake. You know, brothers and sisters, it's sometimes a lot less painful to learn from other people's experiences than our own. We look at some people, the way they live their lives, and we just don't learn the lesson. We step in the same hole. And you can hear the magician saying, learn from the others. Learn from the other experiences. And the magicians are saying, look, you've experienced one plague in your cities, you've experienced another plague in your fields. Do you want 10 before you accept that against this God there is no power? So what little they knew of Hebrew law, they used. And therefore, in chapter 6 and verses 3 through 4, you read this. They said, did the magicians, if you send away the ark of God, the ark of the God of Israel, send it not empty, but in any wise return him a trespass offering, and then you shall be healed, and it shall be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. Then said they, what shall be the trespass offering which we shall return to him? And they said, 5 golden tumours and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines, for one plague was on you all and on your lords. 5 mice and 5 tumours. Sure, the 5 represented the hub of the nation in the 5 lords and the 5 cities. But under the law, brothers and sisters and young people, when a trespass offering was made, it was done when there was an invasion of the rights of the property of somebody else. And the Philistines had invaded the property and the privacy of God. And the payment was to be made in full plus. Now that's Leviticus 5. Just turn back to Leviticus 5. What little they knew of Hebrew law, they used. Leviticus 5 says this. Leviticus 5 and verse 16. And he shall make amends for the harm that he hath done in the holy thing, and shall add the 5th part thereto, and give it to the priest, and the priest shall make an atonement for him with the ram of the trespass offering, and it shall be forgiven him. You look at chapter 6 and verse 5. Or all that about which he hath sworn falsely, he shall even restore it in the principal and shall add the 5th part. So brothers and sisters and young people, the full restoration for the guilty wrong had to be made, but it wasn't enough. They had to go beyond and pay an addition of a 5th part. And so the Philistines offered 5 twice. And what they did, of course, they made these tumours and they made these rats or mice out of gold. Same material as the ark. They knew the presence of the golden chest was the reason of their affliction, you see. And also by the pagan notion of sympathetic magic, these representations of their plague were thought to bring healing by the thing that it represented. So in went 5 little tumours and 5 little mice. But they never presumed, did the Philistines, to lift the ark and place the images of their diseases inside. They made a coffer. That's what the record says in chapter 6. They made a coffer, a little box, and they set it next to the ark. The word coffer there in chapter 6 is used three times. It's in verse 8, it's in verse 11, and it's in verse 15. It simply means, in the Hebrew, a box. But it comes from the root, which means to quiver or to shake with emotion, particularly fear or anger. The root word of coffer is translated elsewhere as be afraid or stand in awe. So you can see this ark going off, brothers and sisters, and there's this little box shaking in awe, shaking in fear as it stood next to this big golden box. The ark was carried into the Philistines' land as a trophy of victory, and it's now carried back with trophies of its own and lasting monuments to the fear and the awe and the disgrace of the Philistines. And the trophies of Yahweh's victory, brothers and sisters, went back in a manner that defied every force of nature. You just listen. Some of you know this well, some of you not so well. Listen to the skill of the magicians. When you send it back, there's five testing points. In 1 Samuel 6, I want you to take two cows that are still feeding their young. Get these two cows that have never had a yoke on their back. And as soon as the yoke touches their back, it would set off a range of tensions. They were already vulnerable by virtue of the fact that they had calves, you see. And as soon as this yoke touched their back, they would quiver with all of these emotions, already strung like a violin. The magicians are going to play on the vulnerability of these two cows. And then it says in the record, it says, bring their calves from them. Well, in the Hebrew, it means this. Tie them to the cart, get these two cows, tie them to the cart, and then have their calves in front of them, and then drag them away while their mums are watching them being dragged away as they're bellowing after their mum. And then the magician said, then send it away. No driver, no one steering them, just send it away and keep watching. And if it goes to the city of the priest, now there's a telling condemnation to the men of Beth Shemesh. If it goes to the city of the priest in its own territory, then we will know. And the record says in chapter 6 and verse 12, and the kine, Rotherham's translation, and the kine went straight along the road to Beth Shemesh. Never turned, never faltered. They went straight to a place, brothers and sisters, they'd never been. Have you ever been and stood on Mount Zion with the Lamb? Have you? Of course you haven't. But God expects you and me to go straight and not falter and not deviate to a place we have never been, brothers and sisters. And all the while those cows were going, they were lowing, it says. In the Hebrew, they were bellowing. And as God looks down from heaven and he sees you and me going straight to a place we've never been, he knows we're bellowing. He knows the pull of our natural instincts are pulling us back. We're bellowing because we're walking against human nature. And God says, keep going straight because the city of the priest is not far away. Deeply affected by all the forces of their natural pull to go back. The rich and the pitiful cry was a testimony to instincts that were so strong, brothers and sisters. And God can hear us cry to him when we are pulled by those instincts. Jesus Christ can hear us. But they went straight. And they went to one of the cities that were given to the family of Aaron when Eleazar was the priest. Oh, it's a full circle. These cows end up in Beth Shemesh, the city that was given when Eleazar, the stone of help, was the priest. That's where they began. They didn't know the stone of help when they lost the ark, and God is just tapping on their tympanic membrane in their ear. Listen. Listen to what's going on. You know, Proverbs 3 and verse 6 says this, in all thy paths acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths. The men of Beth Shemesh, brothers and sisters, should have connected the dots. Verse 14 of chapter 6. 1 Samuel 6. It's all right, I know you're freezing cold and we'll be finished very, very soon. How are they going out there in that... No sunglasses tonight. A lot of beanies and rugs out there. Right, 1 Samuel 6, brothers and sisters. 1 Samuel 6 and verse 14. The men of Beth Shemesh should have tried to connect the dots. Look at verse 14 of chapter 6. The cart came to the field of Joshua. Oh, now there's an echo. Joshua. A Beth Shemite. Oh, Beth Shemesh, the house of the sun. And when it came, the cows just stopped at the great stone. Oh, so I've got three dots to connect. There's Joshua, there's the house of the sun, and there's a great stone. That's Joshua 24. God's saying, go back. Go back to Joshua 24. When we go back to Joshua 24, what were these people supposed to be learning? You come back very, very quickly and pick up a few little points out of Joshua 24. Joshua, the house of the sun, the great stone. That's where the cows stopped. And it was a lesson to the men of Beth Shemesh. Well, you see, brothers and sisters, you read in verse 26, and Joshua wrote these words in the book of the law of God and took a great stone. And what's it all about? They're going to be a witness. Verse 27, Joshua said unto all the people, behold, this stone is a witness. A witness to what? Well, verse 19, Joshua said unto the people, you can't serve Yahweh. He's a holy God. He's a jealous God. He won't forgive your transgressions and your sins. If you forsake God and serve strange gods, he will turn and he will do you hurt. And the people said, we will follow God. This is a witness that you will. Verse 23, put away the strange gods which are among you. And that's what Israel have still got. They've still got the strange gods. Put them away. And the people said to Joshua in verse 24, Yahweh our God we will serve and his voice we will obey. And guess what? In verse 30, then Joshua died and they buried him in the border of his inheritance in the place which means a portion under the sun. Oh, Beth Shemesh, the house of the sun, Joshua, a great stone, put away the idols, listen to God and obey him. Brothers and sisters and young people, when you come back and you look at this record in chapter 6, two men who've been steeped in idolatry brought the ark to Ebenezer and lost it. Two animals have just turned their back on the land of idolatry and brought it back. Hophni and Phinehas did not know their owner. The cows did. That's Isaiah 1 and verse 3. Isaiah 1 and verse 3 says, the ox knows its owner, the donkey knows its master's crib. Israel does not know. My people do not understand. And understand they did not, brothers and sisters, because in 1 Samuel chapter 6 and verses 19 and 20, we read these words, and he smote the men of Beth Shemesh because they had looked at the ark. Not looked into it, they looked at it. And he smote the people, 50,000 and 70 men. Well, that's not true. There wouldn't have been 50,000 there in that place. Some people have suggested to us that the 70 men were slain and maybe the 50,000 represented those that were slain in the land of Philistia. Some have reckoned that the 70 is a standard for all the people there, that it wasn't 50,000 and 70. I believe it was 70 men, but God smote 70 Levites. Because in verse 20, the men of Beth Shemesh said, who is able to stand before this holy God? The ox knows his owner. The donkey knows his master's crib. My people don't understand. What could they understand, brothers and sisters? All they had to do was to go back to Numbers 4 and verse 6. And in Numbers 4 and verse 6, when the ark moved, the priests came and they took the veil down and they walked in and they put the veil over the ark of the covenant. Then they put badger skins over that. Then they put a cloth of blue. And when the record says in Numbers 4 that they cover the ark, the record means in the Hebrew they filled up the hollows. They had to cover it. So you think Hophni and Phinehas took the time to cover it before they took it out of the holiest of holies and down into Aphek? No way! This ark has been going all over the land of the Philistines uncovered. And when it came into the land of Beth Shemesh, the men should have said, "We're not looking because we know what God says. We know his law." And back in Joshua 24, they said, "This is a stone. This is Joshua. This is the place of the sun. We'll obey God." They didn't obey him, brothers and sisters. They didn't obey him at all. And the trouble is, in verse 15, they offered burnt offerings and sacrifices. In verse 15, the Levites took down the ark of Yahweh and the coffer that was in it, and the jewels of gold were in there, and they put them on the great stone, and the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and sacrifices and could not obey God. And the next chapter, the man who coined that statement, "To obey is better than sacrifice," has got to come back. Offering sacrifices and burnt offerings, and have got no idea who will stand before God. These are the priests. We don't know, but we'll offer some burnt offerings and sacrifices. God, because God will be pleased with that. No way. "To obey," says Samuel, and he's coming back. The ox knows, the donkey knows, but Israel hasn't got a clue. Brothers and sisters, 20 years later, in chapter 7, Samuel is going to bring this nation to their knees, and their hearts are going to be poured out like water, and Yahweh will thunder from heaven, and then they will know where their God is. God willing, therefore, tomorrow morning, as we assemble around the table that our Lord has so graciously prepared for us, we will see, brothers and sisters, a remarkable turn from ignorance and idolatry. And we'll actually see Israel embrace Hannah's vow. God willing, we will look at that tomorrow morning.